The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Citizens of Earth and all beings, both extraterrestrial and interdimensional. My name is Danny Roth, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast dedicated to the top stories from the week in geek. I am joined this week by my co-hosts and friends, the Blur Girl, Kara Mahorn, and Sci-Fi Wire's own editor-in-chief, Adam Swiderski. Hello.
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 Happy New York Comic Con 2019.
Yeah.
It's going on right now as we speak.
It is.
So that was what I had to say about that.
Good, thank goodness. Thank you.
I'm still tired because I saw Joker last night, and so I'm very, very sleepy.
Yeah, we sure are gonna talk about that movie, Joker. Also, we'll talk about the Birds of Prey trailer that dropped, Raising Dion a little bit because Karima, you did a lovely interview, so we want to be able to throw to that. And also, we talk about New York Comic Con. Sure. It's happening. Wow.
It is indeed.
It is a thing that it's happening.
But, we do the thing at the top of every show. We talk about things we're personally geeking out about. So let's do that. Karima, what's going on with you this week?
I'm geeking out over a lot of things because Comic-Con. But one of the things actually that happened, I was running around on the show floor and I ran into David Walker, writer of Cyborg and a lot of other comics as well, but Luke Cage, most people know him for. But he's an indie comic called Bitter Root. I've talked about it on the podcast before. It's amazing, and not only is it, I'm not the only person who thinks so, because Ryan Coogler has just announced that he's going to direct a film adaptation of the comic.
Nice. How was he feeling about that? Was he excited? What did you guys talk about?
He was excited, and then he said a lot of people who hadn't talked to him in ages were like just calling him out of blue, like ex-girlfriends and stuff, which I thought was hilarious. Like people who didn't think he was that important are all of a sudden like, hey.
Man, that sounds terrible, but great, but terrible.
The only advice I gave him was like, don't return their calls. We want this film to go through and we don't want your name to end up on page six.
That is...
Oh, for those of you who are outside of New York, that means like gossip page.
Sound advice, Karima. Agree. Hey, Adam.
Yes.
What's going on with your week?
This week, two of my favorite things came together, which is music. Those of you who have been listening to this podcast know I'm a giant, gigantic music fan. Not literally, but also literally.
I was going to say, yes,
yeah,
literally.
I'm pretty gigantic. And and also a fan of science fiction entertainment. And so this week, I am geeking out over Sound and Fury, which is the album/anime released by Sturgill Simpson, who, if you don't know him, he is a country musician, but not in the pop Shania Twain kind of sense. Oh, he's typically been a country musician, but then he's also known for defying expectations. And so he just dropped this album this past week called Sound and Fury, which is complete departure from what he has done before. It is very much a psychedelic Southern rock album. Really, really cool stuff. And then to accompany that, he also released a 45 minute or so anime project called Sound and Fury.
Was this the one with the multiple different artists?
Yeah.
I think I saw part of this recently.
Yeah. It's got a list of names that's a mile long. But I think the person who supervised it was, hold on, I'm looking this up right now as we speak.
One of them was an Asian army.
Junpei Mizusaki,
yes.
Of Kamikaze Douga Animation Studio. There's no dialogue, so it's just basically the album played under a series of anime vignettes. It's really cool.
I remember seeing a feudal Japan army, and then all of a sudden they break out dancing.
Yeah,
or something.
There's a whole para-para dancing sequence,
yes.
In one of the songs. And I mean, it's weird and trippy. Kind of reminds me of heavy metal. If you are of a certain age, you may have remembered that film. From I believe it was the 70s or 80s, I can't remember, probably the 80s, where, you know, you're getting them. It's just basically anime accompaniment to the album, but it's got a lot of Cowboy Bebop in it. It's got, it's, you see influences from all over the anime sphere, but it's its own little post-apocalyptic.
Felt like that MTV Aeon Flux little
Aeon
things
Flux,
used to
yeah,
happen.
I would say the original Aeon Flux, yeah. Not necessarily the one that later had dialogue and an actual like coherent plot that you could follow if you weren't on psychedelics. So yeah, it's really cool. And again, this is an artist that you would not expect this from at all. Because he's traditionally up to now been kind of a country crooner, but it's awesome. And again, I actually, the small plug, I'm interviewing Sturgill Simpson, or I, if you're listening to this after Saturday, I will have interviewed Sturgill Simpson on the live stage here at New York Comic Con. And I'm really excited to talk to him about all that. So that's my thing. Sound of Fury.
Nice. And if you want to listen to his song, The Dead Don't Die, you can hear it in the film, The Dead Don't Die, available now on Blu-ray.
That's right, and see him as a zombie in it. So yeah,
he's in it.
Yeah, he's got a little genre cred, you know, Sturgill at this point.
Nice.
How about you, Danny?
Well, did you see that news that Tom Holland may have saved the MCU Spider-Man thing? Did you see that? I kind of like that. That was a fun story.
I did not actually. Tell me the story.
We've been locked inside of a convention center.
Oh, the story is, you know how like Sony and Disney were in a tussle.
Mm-hmm. I am aware of that. Yeah,
you remember that one? Well, it turns out that when things got resolved, supposedly part of that was because Tom Holland like kept making phone calls to the head of Disney and the head of Sony,
wow,
saying, "Guys, can we all just get along, please? It's me, your sweet baby boy, Tom Holland." And then they listened, supposedly. I don't know how true that is, but that's a story that kind of got out on the street.
There's a line from A Midsummer Night's Dream. I can't remember which of the female leads they're talking about. I think it's Helena, where they say, though she be but little, yet she is fierce. And I think that encapsulates Tom Holland, because he's a wee man. He's a wee man.
I think he works more than most people. He's in he's in everything all the time. And then also apparently, even when he's not in movies, he's brokering deals.
He's W-E-R-K-ing. Mm-hmm. He's working.
Yeah. And when he's not doing that, he's twerking with his umbrella. Ella.
I'm done with you.
Yeah. So he's got, yeah. So that one my weekend, of course, because it's October, I've started watching horror movies that I haven't seen before. I watched an old giallo movie called All the Colors of the Dark. So if you're looking for a movie about a woman who gets pulled into a satanic cult and things happen, that's pretty good. And Vinegar Syndrome put out a re-release of a movie called The Vineyard, which stars and was produced by James Hong. James Hong, if you want to look him up, he's probably one of the most influential horror and genre actors, especially from the 80s. And he made this movie, The Vineyard. He financed a lot of it himself because nobody wanted to make a movie with a leading man who was Asian of any variety, because it was the 80s. And so, yeah, he went through all this work to get this movie made, and he wrote it and produced it. And the director is also Asian. And so, yeah, it's like a weird kind of little bit of zombie, a little bit of almost like a slasher story, a little bit to it, too. It's fun. I enjoy it, and you gotta throw a lot of respect behind James Hong just for the work that he did to get the film made, and it's a really great transfer. So that's my hot recommendation for the week, is The Vineyard, available now through Vinegar Syndrome. That's what's winning my week. Hey, let's talk about a trailer that's good, that Birds of Prey trailer with the emancipating of that lady, Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn.
You know what a Harley Quinn is? A Harley Quinn's role is to serve. It's nothing without a master. No one gives two shits who we are beyond that.
I feel like people have been waiting for that trailer the way that most people wait for whole ass movies.
I agree.
So what do we think? Did a trailer live up to the hype?
I felt like it was a trailer for Harley Quinn and a teaser for the rest of the characters.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I don't remember the rest of the characters in the movie.
I love Margot Robbie in this role, and I think she's going to be great in it again. I would have liked to have seen more of the other characters so that we can get some of the titular Birds of Prey vibe. But I'm assuming that's coming down the road, so I'll try to remain patient. But I thought the trailer was good. It was effective. It was fun. She was great. She looks like she's going to be great again.
What, do you think the visuals were good? Good looking film. Good costumes.
It was. There was a lot. It was good looking, but I felt, and this is just me being an editor again, I just felt there was a lot of wide shots. Mm. I wanted to see some, like, kind of get in a little bit. Go, okay, it's happening. We got some smiles, you know, from her, obviously. A lot of big explosions and booms and boomy things.
Got some hyenas.
We got some hyenas.
Or a hyena.
Yes,
let's just say that.
That's true. I'm kind of like Adam. It's funny. It was a trailer, but it felt like a teaser.
Yeah.
I have a question, but I feel like this is a question that we may have to save for the Joker conversation. But
okay.
They feel related. So there's a moment in the trailer where Harley is talking about how people are scared of other people. You know, but they shouldn't be scared of this person. They shouldn't be scared of Mr. J. They should be scared of her. And then she headbutts the camera. I really like that. But then I found myself wondering why did I look at that violence and go, good. And then I watched Joker and said, bad.
Well, there's a lot of context there.
Yeah.
The impression one gets is that Harley was not talking about, hey, you know, pedestrian who's going to work in the morning should be afraid of me.
And I don't think the two movies are related. I definitely look at Joker as a standalone movie, and we can talk about it when we get there. But I see what you're saying, Danny. I think the proximity of the trailer to the release of the film is on purpose. But I don't think that scene necessarily is. I think because it seems to be so much about, like, you know, her, like, even the title, Emancipation, it's almost like the girls can be violent too. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're scared at them because you're not even looking at me because, you know, you don't think I'm capable of that, but you don't know what I'm capable of.
And it's all on how you couch it. I mean, Batman is violent as hell, you know, as a character and as a property and as a series of films. But who is he punching? You know, who is he headbutting? It makes a difference, I think, contextually. Again, I think tonally it's just going to be, there's not even going to be any comparison between Joker and this film, which I won't say the name of because it's super long.
you can just say Birds of Prey. You're probably safe. People know
Birds
what you're talking about.
Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of Harley Quinn. I can say it. I just choose not to. It didn't thrill me to this trailer to the point where I was like, oh my God, I have to see this movie. But it definitely made me interested. It made me intrigued to see more. For sure.
I like the little girl in the car with Harley Quinn.
Yeah, that was funny. She like tosses her the bomb.
She's like the kid in Up.
Huh?
That's what I thought. I was like, oh, this is like really weird. Like Margot Robbie is the weirdest version of Ed Asner.
Yeah.
That's hysterical.
Anyway, that's my take. Looks good. I want to see it. I was pretty jazzed by the trailer. I'll circle back around. I had a point about the Harley Quinn versus Joker thing, but I'll save it for the Joker part. I just wanted to set, I was teeing it up for me, and now I've done it.
Self high five.
That's it. I really know what I'm doing. So, that's that. Hey, Karima, you did an interview, and I feel like it's something that we should probably talk about before we actually listen to the interview. Can you tee it up?
Last week, one of the things I was talking about was how I was a big fan of Raising Dion, the show that's dropping on, actually it's dropping on Netflix today. I had a chance to talk to the cast. I've seen the first three episodes, and I also had a chance to talk to two of the cast members, one of which is Alicia Wainwright from Shadowhunters. She plays Nicole. And the other is Jason Ritter, who plays a character named Pat. The little boy who plays Dion was not in this interview. And who, those of you who are curious and are old enough, Jason Ritter is the son of John Ritter, the actor, the late comedic actor from the 70s and 80s. And it's a beautiful little story about a single mom who's raising a little boy with superpowers. And it was kickstarted into a comic. The comic was picked up by Michael B. Jordan. And you know what? I'm not going to tell you, actually. I'm not going to give you the elevator pitch. I'm going to let Alicia do that.
All right. Here's that interview.
So let's talk about Dion's Just tell me a little bit. Besides, we know he's got powers and we know his dad, who's played by Michael B. Jordan, isn't around. Tell us a little bit more about the story.
So when you meet Nicole and Dion, it's kind of one of the more difficult days of her life. She just lost her job. She moved to a neighborhood because, you know, when her husband was alive, they were a little bit more affluent. And now they moved to kind of like a rougher neighborhood. And so she's trying to put her kid in a good school, but now he has no friends. And all this stuff is kind of happening. She's super overwhelmed and dealing with the grief of the loss of her husband. And she comes home to find out that her son has superpowers. And, you know, in other things that I've seen, it's kind of this incredible, like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And let's see what I can do. But because it's from the perspective of the mother, she's terrified and she really doesn't like it. And she wants it to go away. So the journey of Nicole and Dion is to kind of figure out how to assimilate back into regular life with this added complication of having superpowers. And, you know, Jason's character Pat gets let into the secret early on, and so he helps kind of guide and mentor Dion.
What did you think when you first saw the script?
Unlike you, I actually didn't know about the project, and I didn't know it was based off a comic book or that there was like a teaser concept out. So I just was clean slate, read the script. And, you know, there's a lot of content circulating around superheroes and in the sci-fi and fantasy genre. But what I really liked about Raising Dion is it's from the perspective of a mother of someone who has superpowers. And I've never seen anything like that. And then secondly, the person with superpowers is a child.
Yeah.
Eight years old. I mean, at that point, what did you even really know about life? So it just kind of elevated the level of how complicated it was. So I had never seen anything like it. And I also love that it's centered around a Black family in Atlanta. And so when I read it, I just was so hungry to read the rest of it and kind of see where their journey took them.
How about you?
I mean, same. I was super excited. It was it felt like something in at the same time took place in a world that I recognize as real and grounded, and a world that I love to escape to. And it sort of brought them both together. And yeah, and I just loved what it was saying, and I loved what it was saying about motherhood and you know, and the fears and the pride and the, you know, the everything that goes into shepherding a young person through life. And even though this is heightened, there's still sort of it's all the same emotions that you go through as a parent.
Yeah, the whole concept of how based it is in reality, because we've seen in the trailer that he clearly has some telekinesis. As we get in the story, we'll talk a little bit about some of his other powers, but when you're trying to punish a child that can pick up a tree, it's a little different.
Exactly.
Like, timeout means something completely different.
Well, and I also like the sort of like the mundane, like the, like, you know, they're at a store and he is like pulling Twix bars to him, you know, like, and just like those simple things of like, don't use your powers, like, to try to eat candy. Like,
right,
you know?
Right.
I love that marriage
of
those.
Stop
two.
It. We've covered this. No teleportation in, you know, in the
after 5 o'clock.
Right.
10
right.
minutes of teleportation time, okay?
Yeah, like the scene when she's trying to get a job and she sees him in another person's office was epic. I'm not going to give away what happens, but just, it was every mom watching their kid in a waiting room, like, please behave.
Yeah.
Please behave.
And then you see your kid act out like, what are you doing?
And then it's just sheer panic because, like, if somebody, you know, sees him.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to spoil it, but I do want to know what you can tell us about Dion's dad, as well as, you know, is Dion ever going to harness his powers, or are we going to have all these episodes of he's just wrecking this house?
I'll take the first one and say that Michael B. Jordan plays Mark. So he has, when the story starts, his character has passed away a few years prior, and he was a brilliant scientist and a STEM researcher who worked at this company, Biona, which is this kind of Google level weather tracking organization and like company, private company. He dies under circumstances where he himself was being a hero. He was saving somebody when they were caught in a storm. And so when we see Michael's character, it's in flashbacks sprinkled throughout the season.
There's an interesting rollout of information that takes place over the course of the series, and not everyone knows everything. There are certain, and they're all kind of varied and different. And
it's woven together nicely.
It's woven together super nicely. And you know, one of the fun things about the show is as the mystery slowly gets revealed, as the onion gets peeled. Mm-hmm. It rhymes. Yeah. I'm a poet, and I didn't even realize that I had the ability to.
That was good. But what is the one thing that you, after you read the script and now after you've seen it, that you want people to walk away from it with, the story with?
I think the show has a lot of fantastic themes and values, but the one takeaway I got from it that I hope people connect with are that single moms are superheroes. Mm-hmm. And one, some of the best compliments that I've gotten through this press tour have been from mothers who have been like, I saw myself in Nicole. You're just always striving to be your best, and sometimes that's all you can do. And so they understand how difficult it is for Nicole to keep trudging through in spite of feeling like she's getting in her own way. Mm-hmm. And I think that if the show finds its audience with young mothers, then that would just make me the happiest. And I know there's a broad base for the show and it's going to reach a wider audience than that. But for me and my character and what I was trying to do with the way I told my section of the story, I hope that young mothers out there feel seen.
Absolutely. And I would say one of my favorite themes of the whole show is a kind of journey through the desire to assimilate into a popular group of people, through to acceptance of your full self and re-looking at the things that make you different as assets as opposed to detriments. And I think, you know, through his relationship with Esperanza, you know, they both are kind of feel different and feel unseen, and yet
Esperanza says it.
Yeah, she says she's when you're
like,
invisible.
Yeah, she's like, oh no, I'm invisible. So yeah, nobody's gonna know. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, and she doesn't say. Oh, she's so great. She's so wonderful. But yeah, I think that's the thing. I think that's something that we can all relate to. And I think, you know, I have a couple friends who, you know, parents and their child is just like a beautiful weirdo, just like says such strange things. And you see how much they're like, that's so incredible. And also, I know people may tease you, but mm-hmm. these are things that will help you in life. You're so creative. You're so wonderful. And it's going to be tough now. But, you know, and I love that. I think, it, you know, it's a journey that we all kind of have to make. And it's tough to know, to realize, oh, I'm cutting off pieces of myself to hang out with this group of people that I don't even really like. I just feel like I'm supposed to try to hang out with them. Mm-hmm. And the sooner we can move through that, the sooner we can accept who we are and build on that to become, you know, to celebrate our uniqueness. And that's the thing that makes it amazing, is that we're all different and all the same in other ways.
So yeah, if you get a chance to watch this show, it's fun. It is definitely a YA show. Like, I felt like watching it was like a YA novel. So just keep that in mind. You can watch it with kids. For some of you who are like, when I say kids, I mean like, you know, like CW. People can handle it. But it is fun. And there's a lot of, they go into sort of social commentary in our longer special version when you hear it, about multiple things. Not just, I think for me, the funniest thing is the fact that we never go into the parents of superheroes ever in comics or in movies because they're dead. Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, they're all dead.
Wait, Batman's parents die?
Well, yeah, a little bit.
I wish I'd seen that on screen in some incarnation
ever,
at some point.
Right?
Yeah.
So basically, it's interesting to see what it's like in the real world when you have to raise a child and they're telekinetic. He's got multiple powers. So yeah, definitely check it out. I'm excited about it and I hope you are too.
Cool. All right. So I will say this. We're tight on time, so we're going to talk about the Joker. But first, we'll take a quick break.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
What a great break. Break of my life, really.
I'm refreshed. I'm ready to go.
All right. So, to the Joker. Karima, help.
I don't know why you're saying help, because I'm still processing.
Arthur, I have some bad news for you. This is the last time we'll be meeting.
You don't listen, do you? You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts? All I have are negative thoughts.
The question that I've gotten from a lot of people is, do I need to know the comics to see this movie? You do not. This is a standalone movie that pulls away from the comics in a very distinct way. It is an origin story of sorts of Joker. It's strange. The one thing that I did find interesting is, they did with Gotham what they did in the Dark Knight movie series, where you knew it felt like New York, but you couldn't figure out what time period, because there were certain things that felt like 80s Reagan era, and there's other things that felt like, wait, that was 1992, you know. So it was, they picked from pop culture and things going terrible in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s in New York, in particular. It is about clearly a person. Honestly, I looked at it from a very, very wide angle. As a intergenerational mental illness kind of situation. And then at a very close view, a very disturbing film. I actually, the first thing when I first thought when it ended was that it was a horror movie. For me anyway, I felt like it was like a horror slash thriller, in the way that it took its time to develop. And then basically explaining a lot of his neuroses. From a visual level, I'm still processing how a lot of the women, particularly the black women, were treated in this film. I don't want to comment on it yet because I'm really, really still processing it. I would not tell people to not see this movie. I actually want people to see this movie so I can have a logical discussion with them, because there's a lot of people who are seeing this movie or talking about the movie that haven't seen it.
Right.
And I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah.
I want to talk to people who've actually had seen it, digested it, and have thoughts on it. I think that the other thing that was very disturbing for me as a human, just me personally, Karima, my screening, the theater was full of police and security, and my theater was full of police and security, which was also added another level of
unease.
Yes, because when you see the film, it has a lot to do with, you know, going up against literally the police.
Right.
A lot of violence, a lot of bodies hit the floor. I don't, here's the thing. Somebody else asked me, is it going to be, would there be a sequel? I don't know. I can't tell. That's, and I know it sounds a lot of, I don't know, but that's literally what I feel.
So here's my summary. It is a fantastic performance, an unbelievable acting performance.
Oh, he's going to get an Oscar.
In a movie and a script that doesn't deserve it. You know, we're going to obviously get into the big discussion. Is this, you know, quote unquote incel bait? Is this encouraging this kind of activity? And my take is that that's not what they were going for. They were going for a commentary on society and how the systems that are in place, particularly capitalist systems, ignore certain people and ultimately do so at their peril. That is a good message, right? I think that's a message. That's something that should be discussed. But the way they do it in this film is so muddled. Some of the choices they make and the, you know, ultimately I was having a hard time figuring out that was the message until they basically, and this isn't a big spoiler for the plot, but they basically have Joaquin Phoenix's character say it out loud in a sentence. Like, he basically says the thesis of the film at one point.
And in a one, for a film that had a very particular pace, everything stops when he says it. Also, no edits or anything. It's just like,
it's just weird.
In case you didn't get it.
And you know, it's like, okay, but then you have to show a lot of that and they don't do that. Like, I agree. Gotham in this movie, what is it? There's no sense, the sense of place that you got out of these old Scorsese films like Taxi Driver or King of Comedy, where it really sold you that gritty 80s New York. This doesn't do that. You get told, things are bad, but you don't feel it because everything is centered around this one character. So you don't get the sense of place. Arthur didn't lose his job because society is mean. Arthur lost his job because he brought a gun to a children's hospital.
Right. And not to kill anybody.
No, just by accident. But still, it contradicts itself throughout. And so, like, by the end of the movie, I was trying to figure out what it was trying to say. And then again, they have him just come out and say it. And so then I was like, okay, if that's what you were trying to say,
you did it wrong.
you fumbled, you know, not just you fumbled, you dropped it down the stairs and it broke into a million pieces as it went down like 50 different flights of stairs. Also, I, as a music person, I really am curious. I would love to talk to somebody about why they chose to use Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part 2 for the now infamous Joker dancing down the stairs scene. For those who don't know, Gary Glitter, the artist behind that, is a convicted pedophile on multiple counts.
Exactly. It was a very weird choice.
Was that part of why they chose to use it? Or if not, why are you putting money in that guy's pocket? And the people, you know, it was a big sporting event thing in the 80s. They always played that song. Nobody does that anymore because Gary Glitter was a monstrous human being. So it's just choices like that and things throughout where you're just like, what are they trying to say? And then again, they come out and say it and you're like, no, it didn't quite, that none of that landed. But again, Joaquin Phoenix is phenomenal in this movie, but he's the only one because every other character is a flat surface.
There's no depth. Zazie Beetz's character has no...
Everybody. Thomas Wayne, everybody. Robert De Niro's character has one dimension and it's weird. And I don't know. It's
even Alfred.
It's a movie that is trying something, but just with a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel, you know? And
I feel like a lot of it was lost in the edit room. Cause like, that's the other reason, like Joaquin was great.
Yeah.
But I feel like even if I don't know what he said, but my thing is like, I feel like at the end of it, they could have even crafted it in the edit room a little bit differently to make it make more sense.
Yeah.
There's just certain things that I was like, I think I get what you're trying to say, but your argument is not supporting them.
Yeah. Danny, I know you had stronger feelings probably on this film than I think either one of us.
So I watched it and then my mother asked me, she texted me and said, oh, you had to see a movie for work tonight. What did you think of it? And I used a word that I have never used about any movie that I've ever seen in my life. And that word is immoral.
Interesting.
The more I think about this movie, the more upset I get about it. I'm deeply bothered by it. And the reason that I'm bothered by it is a lot to do with things that you both touched on. One, that it is trying to say something to the effect of we live in a society, but then it doesn't show that society at all, except through the lens of this one guy. And I can't really get a sense of how bad things really are in truth. And if they wanted to sell me on that, they should have made the city of Gotham a character, and it should have been a central character. So that's one thing. The second thing, Karima, that you touched on was the way in which Arthur interacts specifically with Black women and Black people in general, and also the way
that Latinos.
And the way that they portray, like, oh, here is this Latinx gang that comes through, and that's where the movie starts, is him getting beaten by them. So of course they couldn't possibly be white.
But if, again, that was one of those things that felt like time period to me. Like, that felt like Hell's Kitchen in the late 70s, early 80s. Not just them, just the way the whole thing looked.
Right.
And then when he was talking about when this part is in the trailer, when his caseworker is saying, you know, I can't see you anymore. And it's based on budget cuts for the mentally disabled. It was happening a lot. That's why I thought Reagan era 80s, because when a lot of people from mental institutions even were let out on the street because there was no more money. The only Black woman in the film whose character I actually felt relieved about, and I'm not going to give it away, is Zazie Beetz character, because even though she's not fully fleshed out as a character, his relationship to her is. And that helped me process a few other things. The reason why I need to think about it also is, and this is the problem when you have subtleties in movies like this, I have a sinking suspicion that the entire thing, the entire narrative, was being told in a memento sort of way from the perspective, from not just his perspective, but from his mind. There are things that he was seeing that weren't necessarily reality, including those kids that were running, including, so I'm wondering, but the problem with that is it's so subtle that it can still send the wrong message.
There's nothing in the movie that to me truly suggests that it's all in his mind. There is a very clear delineation in regard to one situation wherein they are very clear that he imagined a thing. And there are, I think, one or two other things wherein they make it pretty clear that this is something that happened inside of his head and not in real life. But, you know, my beef is that, I don't know, if I talk about it the whole way, I'll spoil the film.
Yeah, because it's kind of impossible to talk about without spoiling it. So take your kids from the room. If you're not, you don't want spoilers, this is the part where we're spoiling it. You have been warned. Don't show up in our mentions. So his whole relationship with Zazie Beetz is in his head. There is no relationship. There is, in fact, he ends up in her apartment. I actually am not even clear that he didn't hurt her, because they don't clear it up. You don't see him lay hands on her. You also don't see him lay hands on another therapist that he sees at the end of the movie. But he's walking away from the room with blood on his feet. So you get the feeling that, you know, she caught it. And then also there's the mother on the bus we were talking about before. So there just seems to be, but I also, even though I know you wanted to talk about, you know, how people of color, you know, specifically Black women were treated. I just thought it was really interesting that there were like no Black men except for like security.
Oh, sure. They were on TV.
Right.
Yeah. There was the one guy that he took the file from.
Right. Yeah. Brian Tyree Henry, who's actually now in Eternals.
Crossover.
Yeah.
So here, oh, look, here's my thesis, right? The bottom line is that Todd Phillips, when he was doing press, for this film, said...
Was there press, really?
I don't know that I would say he was promoting it, maybe for a very specific group of people, but not for most folks. But he said, when someone asked, you know, have you portrayed the Joker as a hero? He said, no, he's the protagonist, but he's not the hero. Well, I waited to see the film before I laid judgment on whether or not that was an accurate statement. And I would say, no, he's the hero of the movie. The end of the film is all these people rising up in a society that is being treated badly by the rich, and these are the poor fighting against that, and he is their champion. He's the hero of the movie. He's a murderer, and he is bad about race. Bad about it.
No, he is bad about race, but I will say one thing. I do not think, this is one thing that we differ. I honestly think the end of the movie was a dream sequence. I think when that car got hit, he was knocked out, and I think he woke up in the insane asylum. I do not think that anybody gently pulled his body out of the car and gently lit. I don't think that happened. I honestly think that that was in it, where he went in a mental state where also he was knocked out. I honestly think that's where he went, because it flashed to white. And then after that, you saw him in the asylum, in Arkham Asylum. So that is one thing I will. I'm not saying the race issues weren't problematic. They were very problematic. But I'm just saying that part at the end, I don't think any of that happened. I don't think any of those people stood there praising him. I think it was all in his head. And the thing that they showed with Zazie Beetz was sort of a precursor to show you he also, because he's not getting his meds anymore, suffers from paranoid schizophrenia and delusions on top of the laughing issue.
Yeah, but all right. So here's my counterpoint to that. The reason why I take it at least a little more at face value than you do is because mm-hmm. that's also the scene where they show a person in a clown mask kill the Wayans. And we know that happened.
That definitely happened.
That's the whole thing.
Wait, Bruce Wayne's parents were killed?
I know. I
honest to God, when that scene came up in this movie, I said, oh, come on, out loud. And
no,
I
did
stop
with the
myself.
Pearls. I definitely
Not
said
even,
it.
No, just the fact that they were showing Batman's parents get killed again. It's almost a joke at this point how many times we've seen that on screen. So, I was just like, why in this movie? I know maybe they wanted to, or maybe it is a joke.
Yes.
And a meta level, Todd Phillips is like, hey, we're making a movie. But it was either that or some way to connect it to the Batman universe. But again, just given that that's the complaint that everybody has, is that we've seen that happen so many times. It was almost funny just to have that happen again. I was like, really? I don't know if I would call the movie immoral. I kind of agree with the message that they were trying to sell, right? Which is this idea of rampant capitalism and the disregard of whole entire classes of people being a huge societal problem that eventually is going to come home to roost. I agree with that on a philosophical level. So I can't say that the effort to tell get that message across is bad. I don't like the way they did it, I guess. And it didn't sell it well.
If you're going to tell that story, if you're going to deliver that message, you would better do a damn good job of it.
Right.
That's the reason why I have such a problem, is that the way it is delivered to me is so bad as to be immoral. I was afraid in the theater. That's the truth. There were no cops in my theater, but I sat down. I was watching the movie with a buddy, and this dude, tall, lanky guy, was behind us. And then all of a sudden, he very suddenly slid down and sat in the seat that was pretty close to me. And I occasionally would turn to look at him looking at the movie. And he had kind of a creepy look on his face the whole time. And I thought, is this man going to kill me? I got to the end of the movie and I thought, this movie is designed to inspire bad feelings in people. It's not a feel-good film, and I understand that films like that can exist and be good. I've seen plenty of them. This movie, I left and I said, this is incel bait, and it is bait to incite them to violence. I don't know what the intention was, but it sure has the result of that to me. And I hate the fact that they spent this whole movie where it's like, Here's the black lady on the bus who is rude to him for no reason, and you know, and he feels bad about it. And then the social worker who can't help him anymore, and he complains about how she doesn't really listen to him. And Zazie Beetz, who he has held up as his savior, even though it's completely imaginary, but he's placed all of this on her, a complete stranger. And you know, we finally get to the end of the film and I thought, wow, what a treat. He didn't kill a single black woman in the film. And then literally as the movie ends, he's walking out with his feet all bloodied because he killed just the last black woman that happened to be there. And that made me really goddamn angry.
Yeah.
That's messed up.
I mean, go ahead.
I just don't like that at all. Like, it just, I mean, you know, and again, like, I'm not telling anybody that they have to feel the way that I do. When I say I think something is immoral, that's not me demanding anything. I'm not getting up on a soapbox and saying, don't see the movie. This movie should be taken down. I'm not that sort of person. But that really deep down bothered me.
I think, and it's interesting too, because I think, you know, Karama said, oh, this is a violent movie and the bodies hit the floor. But thinking about it now, if assuming you're correct about what that last shot means, he kills six people in this movie, which is not a tremendous body count, you know, relative to a lot of films that we've seen. But it feels heavier in that sense, the murder and the killing. It feels, I don't know. Again, that to me is not necessarily a bad thing. I've talked a lot about gratuitous killing in movies and how it bothers me. And I wish that they would treat violence with more weight. And this movie definitely does that. But again, in a way that doesn't feel, I don't know, like it feels icky, as opposed to a movie, again, like the one I always cite is Unforgiven, which really gets to the heart of how powerful and terrible a thing it is to take someone's life. That's an example of, I think, a movie that does that really well. This one does treat the violence less cavalierly, I will say, than a lot of other movies out there. I mean, you've got movies where people are getting limbs chopped off, and you know, like John Wick is the one I always show. Like, dozens of people die in that movie. So this movie does treat the violence more seriously, but it just does it in a way that doesn't feel, I don't want to say good, because I don't think it's trying to make you feel good. It's hard to explain, but it doesn't feel constructive. Let me put it that way.
I don't like the way that they portray mental illness in this.
The other thing I was really curious about, because, I mean, again, the movie is at least ostensibly based on Joaquin Phoenix's character saying the thesis statement at the end about not neglecting the mentally ill, which we certainly do a lot of in this country. So the portrayal of mental illness, it's rough.
There's a lot of stuff, again, that could be done with a film like this. The reason why I didn't reject a Joker movie completely out of hand from the word go, and check the record for anyone that's sitting there saying, he said it's immoral and he's been saying it all along. Not so. I said, I think everyone should see the movie first. But, you know, I look at the Joker as a character, and I see his ability to do what they wanted to do, which is have him be a reflection of society, to try and deal with the consequences of ignoring any systemic problem, including mental illness. I am fine with feeling uncomfortable in the theater. My thing about the Joker has always been that I think what makes him so uncomfortable is that a part of you is afraid of him and a part of you is afraid that you could become him. Right? That's the thing about the Joker that makes him so scary. And the one thing that I'll say was not scary at all for me was I got to the end of the movie and I said, you know, as somebody who feels like every emotion they have is always has anger plus. So it's like, I'm sad, but I'm also angry. I'm happy, but I'm also angry. I'm anxious, but I'm also angry. You know, I've always got that fear in me. But I got to the end of this movie and I thought, I am definitely not that guy. I have no fear of becoming this version of the Joker at all. And I don't know that that's good or bad. I just, it was a response that I had. I was like, yay me. I'll never be that. But I think it's
a flaw in the storytelling too, because wasn't it in the Killing Joke? That was the line, was one bad day, right? They kept using about the Joker. Or am I conflating that with another property? I can't remember.
Oh, the one bad day, that's a Punisher thing.
Punisher, yeah. So it's like, it's just the idea of, and then this was in a review I read prior to the film, so, and I wish I could remember the name of the writer, so I'm sorry that I'm copying your point, but you never get, I don't get the impression from the beginning that he could be saved no matter what. Like, he was already incalculably damaged. So it's not like, oh, if only things had gone right, it would have been okay. It's like, no, there was no salvation for this character from the beginning. You know, I mean, he was in treatment. He was, for however shoddy it might have been, given the state of the funding and everything, it just never felt like you said, you never see a reflection of yourself in this character because of who he is at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't think that the writing of him is very good. And I think the complete lack, as you said, that everything else is so one-dimensional.
Yeah.
I also see as not just poor writing, but as a danger. That's a dangerous thing to do.
I agree.
Because if you're going to have somebody slide into that role, because what if somebody does? I didn't, but that doesn't mean that it's not possible that some people were going to go in and go, I get him. And I also feel like this special individual that the world has got down. And maybe if I just scream loud enough, maybe if I just finally break out and do what I've always wanted to do, which is just have a flash of violence, it will inspire others. That is no bueno. I'm sorry. Like, I just can't find a way to look at this and go, well, it's art, and therefore, like, well, it's art. And so I've judged this art bad. Not good. Not good for the world, and not good, period. And, you know, again, people can think whatever they want. I'm not here to tell people how they have to feel. But I did not walk out of that film going, that was worth it.
Yeah,
I don't think it was.
And I'll just cap this by saying that if you want to see a fantastic film starring Joaquin Phoenix in an amazing performance that deals with mental illness and features incredibly written, well-written characters, I would recommend The Master by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Great film.
Yeah, and it's that I kind of thought about that as I was leaving The Joker, because again, because of the Joaquin Phoenix connection, but and he uses some of the same methodology in terms of this bottled up, you know, rage that's under this weird surface, but it's just such a masterpiece of a film from a writing standpoint, and it accomplishes, I think, what a lot of this movie was trying to accomplish and just didn't.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway,
so that's the period on the end of my sentence.
There's a million things that we could say, but we got to wrap it up. So that is our show. Thanks for listening. If you have not subscribed to Who Won the Week, please subscribe to Who Won the Week. If you have never given a review, please give a review. It helps us out a great deal. Make sure you're listening to all the other podcasts in the Sci-Fi Wire family. You got your Lost retrospective. It's called Through the Looking Glass, Strong Female Characters, Battlestar Galactica, Geeksplain, Debate Club, Untold Story, Fandom Files, Forgotten Women, a Genre, Boarding Party, Behind the Panel, and on and on. And also make sure that since we're at New York Comic Con, we're going to be having live footage. We're also going to be having a corresponding podcast called From the Con. So a lot of the stuff that we have that's going up on the live stage and at other events is going to wind up in podcast form. So if you just want to have something in your ear, that's also going to be an option to you. As we wrap up, I know the camera has already left. If you want to find her online, she's on Twitter and Instagram at The Blur Girl. That's TheBlurGurl. I don't think I made that up.
That's correct.
All right, I got it. Adam, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me on Instagram at RockTheFaces.
And my name is Danny Roth. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. This has been Who Won the Week. Thank you for winning our week. And we'll see you again next week.